Shall we begin? I don't know why that always works better, but it does. Last time we were talking about the designation and organization of use. How is it that we seem to have a basic human need to designate and organize uses? And we talked about three reasons why that is clear in kind of primal society. It's a practical thing. You know, the little kids, if they play over here, they're not getting into the cooking and the fire that's going on over here. It's practical. A second thing is it's a way of embedding certain cultural norms. Things like in the case of the Aborigines, the young men spending their time over here, the young women spending their time over here as a means of birth control. And we still today embed those kinds of, sometimes it's a way of reducing conflict, sometimes it's a way of embedding certain attitudes or values. That's part of it. And the third thing is it's a way of actually claiming something, saying this is mine, this is my turf. By designating certain uses here, I make it my own. Those are things that traditionally have been part of the designation organization of use. We talked about two things then in contemporary culture that advanced that somewhat. One is that we now are so phobic about time management, efficiency, convenience, and organizing, designating uses is a way of making our lives more convenient and efficient. So this becomes a primary driver in office planning, in planning of an industrial area, in planning our homes, all of those things. How can we make it efficient and convenient? And then another sort of contemporary thing is we're very now beholden to our machines, and our machines are often stationary. So we make certain places for certain things because we have our dishwasher and our stove and our cooktop and our refrigerator. So we cook there because we have all these machines that go with it, and that's true in other ways as well. So there are all these reasons why we designate and organize uses. And we looked at some examples of how that plays out in various buildings. And then the Twitter card question asks you to identify a place where you could see this design is very driven by taking certain uses, designating certain areas for that, organizing them in such a way that they work well. So here's some examples. Somebody says, consolving dining hall is driven by function. One first walks through the dining space where they can map out where they'll sit and spot friends before they enter the food lines, arranged on the walls, with the cooking space connected and placed on the outside. Walking out, you don't pass through the food space again, which helps prevent congestion. The place for your dishes is right by the exit, and they are cleaned in the adjoining room. A smooth, perfect process. I think that's a great example. While laying out a dining hall, really, really important to get it right. You don't want confusion and congestion and are people missing something in the process that they, you know, should be part of. It's very simple, but those are very, very important things in planning something like a dining hall. Someone else says, in my high school, they built a new library around 2005, which became the focal point of the school. It has large windows and is surrounded by beautiful courtyards, which make it very inviting. There are also classrooms to the south of the library building that make it easy to go from class to studying. Great function. So they're more the relationship, a new space that has the right relationship to classrooms and things that would be adjoining it. Somebody else says the Gates Dell complex on campus is a prime example of a piece of architecture that surrounds function. The lobby is designed to be an open, welcoming area where students can meet and study together. Upper levels become more private with desks and open group studies provided as well. Outside spaces are incorporated for those who wish to escape reality for a bit. Not sure why nature is not reality, but studying computer science is reality. That's interesting. When thinking of a building driven by function, I think of my grandparents' old lake house, designed and built completely by my father and grandfather. It had a dog trot with tall ceilings for welcoming guests on one side, and the social areas, kitchen, living, dining, on one side, and on the other side, bedrooms. It worked very well, and I have fond memories of this house. Somebody else says, my elementary school was driven by function. At the front of the property is a reception area and carpool zone. Lower level classrooms are closest to this area, so the younger kids don't have to walk very far to their classrooms, and the more advanced levels radiate outwardly consecutively. So as the kids get older, they take on more responsibility. A final response, someone says, Moore Hill Dorm has a design that inspires student interaction. The courtyard encourages students to throw events together, while the communal room indoors encourages casual interaction. Now, I'm actually going to build on that last comment about Moore Hill Hall. So David Sherritt, one of the TAs, and I were involved in a study with a bunch of people from liberal arts looking at student housing at UT. And the basis of that study was to try to figure out, does your performance as a student at UT depend to some extent on where you live? Does the physical environment you live in actually have an impact on your GPA? So these days, UT is on a mission to get for your graduation, to get people to be successful and not have dropouts and not have failures and things like that. So they're looking at every mechanism possible. Can we get special mentor programs? Can we have special sections of classes? Whatever. And one of the things the group of us were arguing is that one of the things you could do is make a better living environment for people, and it will actually freaking improve their GPA. Or improve their success and their four-year graduation rate. So at the courses level, we just looked at, okay, what's the average GPA in all of the 14 on-campus living units? And I will tell you that the deviation is huge. The lowest performing dorm has a full 1 point GPA less than the highest performing dorm. I think that would shock most people. One whole GPA point. I ain't going to tell you what the loser dorm is or the winner dorm is, but I'm telling you, there are some dorms on the campus that average 1 point GPA lower than other dorms on the campus. So then maybe some of those are honors dorms, and maybe some of those are rich kid dorms, and they had better high school experience. I mean, there's all kinds of variables, right? It might not really be the dorm. It might be something else. So then we took another stab at this and said, okay, there is, most of you don't realize this, but in the admissions process, all of your data is put into a piece of software that predicts your success in college. And that's your undergraduate, your high school grades, your GPA, your class rank, your parents' level of education, your income, your family income, it's all kinds of things that are in this profile. All those little things you put on your application, it goes into this database, and this software predicts what your GPA will be at UT. Isn't that interesting? And then that's how they decided you get in. You were predicted to have a GPA better than some loser who ended up at A&M, right? I mean, it's as simple as that. So there is this software, and every single freshman at UT has a prediction of what GPA they're going to make. And it tends to level out whether you were a good student or high school or whatever. I mean, it's just going to predict your GPA. So we said, okay, let's look at each dorm by whether their students did better than predicted or did worse than predicted. And so and it was a lot of work, and there was a lot of help from all the people in admissions and these sub-deans and various, and got all this data sorted out and looked at, okay, what was their freshman GPA and what was their predicted GPA? And we looked dorm by dorm. Did the students perform better or worse than was predicted? And again, there was a very large deviation among the various dorms. And I will tell you that the dorm that had the highest performance above what was predicted was Moore Hill Hall. That one that person just wrote about. So why is Moore Hill Hall? And this is not anything anybody knows. If your parents knew that Moore Hill Hall produces the best GPAs on this campus, wouldn't they want you to live in Moore Hill Hall? But nobody knows that. Now, why would Moore Hill Hall have higher performing students than other dorms that will remain nameless? And so we, in this class, we did some questionnaires and some essays and various things several years ago. And we especially focused on what do people say about the dorm they lived in? What makes it encourage them to have high performance, high academic performance, and what discourages high academic performance? And the people in Moore Hill Hall said pretty much what that response said. This is a place where day one, I felt at home. I could make friends easily because when I walk in the door, there's social spaces there, there are activities, there are study spaces. When I come and go, if I'm going to the rest of the campus, I can just hang out there a minute. I'll run into somebody else I know. We'll walk the campus together. There's just casual interaction. It's easy to get to know people in Moore Hill Hall. It's also about the right size where I can kind of know by face everybody who lives here. But on each floor, I can really kind of know by name the people who live here. So there's an intimacy and a connection that's there. It also happens to be a place where you can have the quiet and the privacy and the study areas where you can do that nerd work. But also at the same time, there are places where you can have collective study groups or socialize, and it just seems like a healthy environment for a freshman to feel well-adjusted and happy and able to do their work and perform and get a better GPA. It just works that well in Moore Hill. And then there are other ones where it doesn't work very well, and we get all kinds of comments about loneliness, alienation, isolation, too much noise, can't study, have to always go somewhere else, no place for group study, just all kinds of things that don't work. So is it possible that your success at this university is being enhanced by or deterred by the places where you live, either on campus your freshman year or off campus subsequently? Is that possible? So that's kind of the topic we're talking about today, this notion of architectural determinism. Now, this is beyond convenience or function or those kinds of things, but does the architecture actually make you a certain kind of person? Subliminally, unconsciously, but it either makes you a better student or it makes you a worse student. Or it makes you happier or it makes you less happy by these human factors. So we're going to roll back a little bit of sort of academic history on this. This topic has been studied a great deal ever since World War II. And there was a very famous study done in the 1940s at MIT, early 1950s, by a guy named Kurt Festinger. He was a psychologist. And he looked at married student housing at MIT. And it was temporary housing that had been brought there after the war. There was a huge influx of older than average students. These guys had been in the war. They didn't get to go to college. They now are coming back from the war. So now they're a lot of them are married. So they had this big barracks, series of barracks they brought into temporary married student housing at MIT. And Kurt Festinger studied that to see, how do people form friends? How do they make social contact? So these were all people from all over the country. They didn't know each other, husbands and wives. And how do they make friends? And one presumption at the beginning was, well, they'll clump together by geographical area. The people from the Deep South will find that they have more in common with other people from the Deep South, and they'll become friends with them. People from New York City, they'll find the other people who are from New York City, they'll clump together because they have that in common. The Texans, of course, will find each other, and they'll all be tight because they're Texans, right? But in fact, no, wrong. There was no real correlation between friendship formation and geographic origin. So the second thing they looked at was, well, what about the things they're studying? One of the couple, at least, is a student. And so if you spend all day over in the electrical engineering department, when you run, think, well, all these nerdy little electrical engineers like me, yeah, those are going to be my buddies. And so, you introduce your spouse to their spouse, and, you get to be friends. You play cards together, go to movies together. You're buds because you have that discipline in common. You're all chemists, or you're all electrical engineers, or you're all business people, or whatever. And they look for that correlation in friendship patterns. Nope, that had no correlation either. People did not clump by discipline. The one thing that seemed to determine friendship formation in that group was physical distance and functional distance. It was where you lived and where someone else lived. It was the physical arrangement of those apartments in that complex. So if I live next door to somebody, I'm probably going to get to know them, and then we're going to get to be friends. It's just as simple as they live next door to me. How many times have you heard somebody say, oh yeah, my wife and I met in college. Well, how'd you meet? We lived in the same apartment complex. That's a huge decision in your life. Who the hell you're going to marry? What was that dependent on? It was dependent on she lived next door to me. So I'm telling you, go out there and look at your neighbors, okay? That may be your future spouse. But this is huge in terms of how we make social contact. Just physical distance. Who lives near who? And then the other thing is what Kurt Fessinger called functional distance. And that has to do with what patterns you move through. So if, in fact, in these barracks buildings, there were rows of apartments and they opened onto an open balcony on two levels. If you lived in the apartment farthest away from the campus, you got less people walking by your front door than if you lived in the apartment closest to the campus where everybody was walking by your front door to go down the stair and go toward the campus. And the people who lived at the end of the building near the campus or by the stair, they had lots more friends than the people who lived at the other end of the building. And the people who lived by the mailbox, which was at the bottom of the stair, those people had the most friends because just people walked by. And if they happened to leave their door open or sit out on their porch, or then they could see those people and they interacted with them and they had casual encounter. And as a result of that, they made friends and they became a part of a community. So physical distance and functional distance were the largest determinants of how people made friends in that kind of informal group. Now, I mentioned in the class earlier, there are lots and lots of studies that have been done since then. Lisa Hishong, who wrote Thermal Delight and Architecture, she did a whole series of studies about school children in elementary schools in California. And then she did another one in Oregon and Arizona and various other places. But basically saying that school children's performance in both reading and in math is significantly improved if there's more natural light, daylight. And that actually, first they did this sort of discovery of that, and it was significant. If you had big windows, if you had skylights, the students in those classes performed better. And it actually turns out, well, when you have lots of daylight, especially when you're a child and you have lots of daylight, it increases serotonin production. Serotonin is a natural antidepressant. It makes you more alert. It makes you happier. And in fact, all these little kids getting that sunlight, upping their serotonin production, were more alert, more able to learn, And they had higher performance advances in both math and in reading. There again, architectural determinism. You know, I said that Winston Churchill quote, "We shape our buildings, thereafter our buildings shape us." Do they really shape our friendship formation? Do they really shape our performance in elementary school? Do they really shape our GPA in college? You know, evidence seems to point in that direction. I also mentioned earlier this study by Roger Ulrich, many studies by Roger Ulrich, this guy who looked at hospitals and in particular studied one hospital with a double-loaded corridor down the center, identical rooms on either side. The rooms on one side looked into a blank wall 20 feet away. The rooms on the other side looked into a beautiful garden. And the people who looked into the beautiful garden had much higher recovery rates, much less painkiller required, and they got out of the hospital faster. Just by that one thing of a soft, green, natural view, as opposed to a hard, no view. So, today the topic is architectural determinism. How do buildings, arrangements of buildings, affect our behavior? Now, there was all of this, these studies and these sociological things done, especially in the 1960s, early 1970s. There was even one guy who wrote a book called Defensible Space, a guy named Oscar Newman, who said, we can get rid of crime if we just design our neighborhoods properly. If we, you know, put, let's say, an apartment where you can always look out your kitchen window and see where your car's parked, that there will be less thefts in that area because thieves will understand that somebody's keeping their eye on their car here and I can't steal it because I'll get caught. That design element can reduce crime. And he had about a zillion other things of ways to reduce crime. So people got all on board for this and they said, well, damn, let's just tear down all these neighborhoods that have been built without this knowledge and we'll rebuild all these neighborhoods and design them exactly right and we won't have crime. And people will be friends with each other, and their kids will learn better in school, and we'll have utopia. Everything will be great. We just have to design it right. And in fact, in the 1960s, LBJ had this big program he called Urban Renewal. We're going to tear down all these ghettos, these nasty neighborhoods where there's crime and there's, you know, negligence, and we're going to rebuild them, and we'll rebuild them right, and then everybody's behavior will be great. So they actually started doing that. They're huge projects. There was a huge urban renewal project here in Austin. And there are many, many on the East Coast, Boston, New York, Philadelphia. But guess what? When they tore down the old neighborhood and they built a new neighborhood and they put the people back in, they tore out the plumbing, got the copper, sold it so they could buy cocaine. They sprayed graffiti all over the walls of the brand new buildings. It didn't work. People didn't transform like that when they got put in a new environment. So what are we supposed to conclude by that? Was all that research stupid? Can we in fact, with the physical environment, can we make our lives better? And I would say that we have to be realistic about this. There is not a one-to-one relationship between a certain physical environment and a certain behavior. I cannot design a dormitory and assure that everyone in that dormitory is going to have lots of friends and they're going to have a high GPA. Can I design a dormitory that enhances that? Yes. Can I make people behave in a certain way with the physical environment? That's probably overstating the case. So I'm going to describe here a relationship between physical environment and behavior, between physical environment and use. And I'm going to suggest that it's not a hand-in-glove fit, it's not a tight fit, it's a loose fit. I'm going to say that there are three different kinds of relationship between behavior and physical environment. There are what we might call conforming uses, where you design an environment for a particular purpose or activity, and it is pretty certain that that activity is going to happen there. That is a conforming use. The second thing is we're going to call it an implied use, that by the design of that physical environment, there's an implication some things will happen there, but maybe not also. There's an implied use. Or the third thing is what we'll call accommodated use. It's possible for these things to happen there, maybe not even implied, but it's possible those things could happen there. And it may be unpredictable. It may be something the architect never thought of. But those accommodated uses may happen there. So, yeah. Okay, the first is conforming use. The second is implied use. And the third is accommodated use. Okay, so let's have an example here. Let's think of the most deterministic environment we could possibly imagine. What is the very most constrained and deterministic environment we can imagine? A bathroom? That was good. Did you say that? Way to go. That was good. But I'm going to do one before the bathroom, okay? Even more constraining than a bathroom is a coffin. A coffin, okay? It's an environment that we design for dead people. And there is a very, very strong conforming use, right? It is for burying dead people. And the dimensions of it, the depth, the width, the length, the materials it's made out of, the waterproofing, everything in there is about somebody being dead and being buried. That is the conforming use and is designed really specifically for that use. Okay, but even when we designed it very specifically for that use, you know, there are also some other implied uses from that. So last Friday was Halloween. There were tons of coffins being bandied about on Halloween. Were they burying dead people? No, they weren't burying dead people. But when you make a form that is for burying people, it makes us a little queasy. It makes us a little frightened, maybe, because we're afraid of death, and that's an emblem of death. So implied in the design of a coffin is this kind of uneasiness or horror. You use it to scare people. And so at Halloween, it's a ubiquitous form that is used not to bury people, but to scare people. So you go to any haunted house, you're going to find a coffin. And the coffin is there, and its implied use is to scare people. You with me? Okay. So let's think of some accommodated uses of a coffin. So think about it. A coffin makes a really fantastic flower box. I mean, it's just the right depth for the soil. You just fill it with dirt. You plant posies in there. It's waterproof, so you can water it, and it's going to keep the moisture there. It makes a fantastic planter box. It's accommodated use. I also heard a story about a guy who ran an antique shop, and a young couple came in his antique shop, and he had several years before, he had purchased a coffin. And this coffin had been commissioned by a very wealthy guy who thought, I'm not going to let my kids put me in some pine box. I'm going to get this really badass coffin, and I'm going to make sure it's in place before I die. So he had somebody do this beautifully carved wood coffin, and he then had it delivered to his house, but found out, oh, shit. That's spooky to have my coffin sitting around in my house when I'm not dead yet. So he decided I don't want it anymore. And he was rich, so he didn't have to worry about it. So he just got rid of it. And this antique dealer ended up buying it because it was beautiful, beautifully crafted. He thought, it's just such a beautiful thing. So he had it in his antique shop for ages, and nobody ever came in and bought it. So this young couple comes in, and they're looking for a coffee table. And he said, well, actually, I don't have a coffee table, but I have a coffin table. And they looked at it and thought, well, it's about the right height for a coffee table. It's about the right length. It goes right in front of the sofa, just the right length. Plenty of place for magazines and bric-a-brac on there. It's beautifully carved, so they brought it home and made it a coffin table. That's an accommodated use. So even when we design something so specifically, there still are other things we can't predict that people are going to do with that. So this is not a hand-in-glove fit. This is not a tight fit between physical form and function. It's a loose fit. There are conforming uses, there are implied uses, there are accommodated uses. Okay, now we need to get to the bathroom, okay? Anybody have to go to the bathroom? We're going to go to the bathroom now. Okay, so talk about, which is a very specifically designed environment, a very deterministic environment, right? Bathrooms, cool. We're going there. Okay, so we're going to think of a dormitory bathroom, what's sometimes called a gang bath in a dormitory, where this is not like your tasteful little suite bath that's just like your bathroom at home. This is like for everybody on the floor. So like maybe there's 6 toilets and 8 showers and 10 sinks, and everybody on the whole floor shares this bathroom. Okay, how many of you have ever lived in such a bathroom? Okay, cool. So, you know, it's sometimes called a gang bathroom, but it means that it's for lots of people. So the conforming uses of that bathroom very clearly are to take a shit, to shave, to put on your makeup, to take a shower. These are conforming uses, and it's designed extremely specifically for those uses, right? Those are conforming uses. There also are some implied uses there. If you have 30 college students who live on a floor, and they share a bathroom, and in the morning when people are trying to get up and get ready to go to class, and they all go in there at the same time, and the guys are maybe shaving, or the women are putting on their makeup, and you're standing in front of the sink, and there's a mirror there, and there's some guy over here, and there's some guy over here, and you're all shaving, brushing your teeth, that kind of thing. You are going to talk to those people. You are not just going to stand there and completely ignore them. You're going to say, God, I don't know what to do with these zits. They're just like driving me nuts. And it's going to, you know, you'll get a little facial care advice. Or you're going to say, you know, oh, you're in my chemistry class, aren't you? Yeah, let's study together for that test that's coming up. Or, you know, you're going to talk. And so these places become places of social interaction. It's implied. It's not that you're necessarily designing for that conforming use, but they become a place of social interaction, a place to chat it up, to gossip, to, just shoot the shit. I mean, you just do in a place like that. So that's an implied use. So there also might be accommodated uses. So I lived in such a bathroom my freshman year in college, and it was a very eccentric version of this kind of bathroom. So there, it was long and skinny. And it had at one end sink, with a little bit of prep area in front of it. And then it had urinal, with a little area in front of it. And then it had shower, with a little area in front of it. And then it had toilet stall, with a little area in front of it. So it was all of them, all against one plumbing wall. So all the plumbing was in that one long line, very efficient. And then all the fixtures, and then this common sort of passageway that gave you access to all of them. And it was super long. It was a bizarre, bizarre bathroom. So in my dorm, there were these crazy guys that lived right next door to me. Both of them were baseball jocks. And they started the third floor John Olympics. And the idea is that we would create games that you could do in this long, skinny space. So, of course, it was really easy to turn the shower head out. Everything's totally made out of tile. So you turn the shower head out, or you take the sinks and you splash water, and you get it really wet all on that ceramic tile on the floor. And then there would be all kinds of, you know, things where you jump, skip, and slide bare ass as far as you can down this thing. And then we'd tape a marker and say, okay, this was spec November 3rd, 2014. And, you know, everybody had, and we were, you know, trying to get the record of how far you could slide bare ass after one jump and a skip and over the line. So this is accommodated uses. I mean, this wasn't, nobody planned for Olympic Games in the bathroom. But it was accommodated use by the form that was created. And it was cool. It was a great thing. I knew another dormitory. There was a friend of mine who actually lived in Morrison Stiles Colleges at Yale that we looked at by Eero Saarinen. We looked at it because of the masonry and the construction of it. But inside, it's got a very interesting arrangement of spaces. It has suites, and so there will be like a stair tower, and off the stair tower there will be a living room on this side, a living room on that side. Then there will be a little corridor with six or eight rooms on it, and there will be a bathroom. And then it connects to another suite that has a bathroom and six or eight rooms and a living room, and then stair towers there. But because in buildings you need two means of egress, they didn't want to duplicate those stair towers, so they put a door between the two bathrooms so that you could exit from the individual rooms. You could exit through the bathroom, through another bathroom, down the hall, and get to a stair that way, or you could, in your own suite, go through the bedrooms and through the living room into the stairwell. So there were perfect little suites, and it all made great sense, but there happened to be this bathroom between this door between the two bathrooms. And people would figure that out. So my friends lived in one of those, and they had this door, and they realized that we know the people who live in the suite on the other side of that door. So they disabled the alarm that would normally have gone off, and they opened the door between the two bathrooms. And then they sort of had a double-sized suite, so they would go back and forth between those because they knew their friends there. And then they decided at a certain point, as it was perfectly natural, that they needed to have a party with both suites, right? Okay, well, they got a living room down here and a living room down here, and then rooms and then bathroom. It doesn't make sense to have a party in two different living rooms. What is the space we all share? It's the bathroom. So they decided to have a big party in the bathroom. And I mean a big party. Invite all their friends over and have music and dancing and everything in the bathroom. And they were fairly spacious bathrooms, but it was great. I mean, there was the sink there for the bar. It worked well. Plenty of places to sit on stools in there. The music sounded fantastic because it was all hard surfaces. It was extremely reverberant in there. Whoever thought, you know, it's a great party space. That's accommodated uses. Okay, for any architectural form, we can have conforming uses, implied uses, and accommodated uses. And that's really the way it works. It isn't that we can design something and say exactly what's going to happen, but it certainly is the case that we can make some conforming uses that we can be pretty sure will happen. If you make a bathroom on a dormitory floor with 30 people and you put some Johns in it, people will take a shit. They will. You can. It's a conforming use. You can be sure that's going to happen. If you make a sink, people will shave there instead of shaving in the hall. They will. So there's some things you can predict. And then there are other implied things and there are other accommodated things. Okay, so let's look at a few examples of how this might play out. And we're going to continue this theme of looking at student housing. Maybe because student housing is one of those things that I think actually does have a huge impact, and certainly in the literature that's been proven out pretty thoroughly. So the first example we're going to look at here is a dormitory at MIT. In fact, it is right adjacent to that area on Briggs Field where Kurt Fessinger did this study of married student housing. And when Alvar Aalto was hired to do this building at MIT, that student housing was there, and he knew of Kurt Festinger's study there. And the MIT client knew about it, and they said, look, we're understanding how much the design of this dormitory impacts friendship formation of people coming into the university. So we want that to be a priority in the design of the dormitory. And Aalto was all over that. He was definitely a guy who thought human factors were the seminal thing that frames and forms architecture. So this is Aalto on the left. He was about 50 years old when he did the building. That's a photograph of him at that age. And on the right is Baker House. It has a very privileged site. It's right on Charles River is right here. You look across the Charles River, you see the skyline of Boston. It's got a beautiful view. That's also a south orientation in Boston. You want as much south sun as you can possibly get. It's cold, cold, cold up there. And so you want that low winter sun to come in. And so there was a lot of frontage along there for south sun that was good. So he was interested in the views, and he was interested in the sun. And he was interested very much in the social climate he was producing in this dormitory and making it a good place for all these little nerds from all over the country who don't know each other and get dumped into MIT to actually be able to make friends and have a sense of community and reinforce in a positive way their performance at MIT. So this is, as you can see, the Charles River here. Beautiful, beautiful basin of the river. It's very wide. It's gorgeous. Across, you can see Boston skyline across there. This is the main dining hall. It's in a privileged position to get those views. That dining hall then opens onto a terrace, beautiful outdoor space to enjoy the views and the basin. There's this interesting little, what the students call the moon garden on top of the dining hall. So if you're looking down on it, it's not just an ugly roof. It's got grass and turf there. And then it's got these skylights, and it's got little lights that go up above the skylight. So at night, the light can shine through exactly like it does during the day. So the lighting at night is kind of like it is during the day. Also, it's a way when it snows, they can turn on the lights, and it heats up the snow and melts it, and then you get the light down into the space. It was a clever way to think about how you deal with that roof. But that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about how you deal with the function of this dorm. So Aalto left these wonderful drawings that really documented his thought process on this. And I will tell you, this is one building I know my ass on this building. I am the world's expert on Baker House. There's recently a book that came out on Aalto. I wrote the chapter on Baker House, okay? So I have looked at every freaking scrap of paper this guy ever drew anything about Baker House. I've looked at all the correspondence. He was back in Finland. His client was in Boston, so there's lots of documentation of his correspondence. It's just a fascinating process to figure out how did he design Baker House. So he started out with these little diagrams. And on the right, he had a series of pluses, advantages of this little scheme, or minuses, disadvantages of this scheme. So he had the plan view of it, a little three-dimensional view, and positive or negative factors. So he starts out with this scheme, and he's rating it in terms of light and view and number of students and privacy. All those are the factors up here. You can't read them very well. But so this one just totally sucks. Lots of minuses, terrible privacy. Everybody's looking at each other's windows. Not very good views because the views are out here to the south and only the ends get the views. Not very good sun because it's all facing east and west. Nobody's getting that beautiful south light. But they're getting the number of people that are supposed to be in there. 300 is what they were shooting for, and that's in the plus column. So then he comes down here, okay, what if we slide them back and forth so you get a little more view out, you get a little less violation of privacy. Still, it's okay, it's not great. How about if we make them farther apart and taller? How would that be? What about if we cant the edges so they get more orientation to the view and to the south? What if we spread them apart farther? And, you know, what does that do? What if we just make it long like this? Well, it turns out then you can't get enough students there. So now it's beginning to get a few things in the plus column of light and view and privacy, and fewer in the minus column, but you can't get enough students with that one. So then he's continuing over here. How about just a long straight thing, and all the rooms are oriented to the south? Fantastic. Great privacy, great view, great sun, but you can't get nearly enough students. So what if you give a little more perimeter, try to get a few more students? Well, still great view, privacy, but not enough students. What if we wiggle the hell out of it? Why don't we make lots and lots of wiggles? And he refines it and refines it until he's getting 300 students, an excellent view, excellent sun, and excellent privacy. So he's thinking through all of these amenities, these lifestyle things for the students, and trying to optimize them on the site. He then takes it just a little further, makes a little kink here, pulls a little thing out here to, again, try to get that larger number of students. Now he's working on the first floor. This is how you come from MIT. The first thing you come into is a lobby. That's where the elevators are. Then you go into the dining room and the living room, that little pavilion out in the front. Over here is like the library and a music room. He's thinking through, you know, how are these people going to interact and what kind of common facilities and where should it be placed and what is their path like and how will they informally come in contact with each other? And then over here we begin to get, even on the first floor, some of the student rooms. He's refining it. And finally he comes to this plan. Now actually he came to a plan first with the 300 students. And then, and they were way, way, way along with the drawings, ready to build the thing. And then MIT did one more kind of financial analysis of the building and decided that to make this work financially, we need 360 rooms instead of 300 rooms, or 360 beds instead of 300 beds. And there was all this flurry of, you know, letters back and forth between all the people involved in it, and Alta was super frustrated with the client. It really warms my heart as an architect now to think that even a really great architect like Alto gets this crazy-ass thing, you know, thrown at him at the last minute. And so anyway, he recoups, and what he does is adds, originally all of the rooms face south. All of the rooms had that view of the Charles River, and all of them had good privacy. One of the things this twist did is it wasn't right angles, so people could look out, but they're not looking into each other. So that was really working well with 300. When he had to add 360, he put a few more rooms over here. They're facing west, which also is good heat gain. Terrible for us where we worry about too much heat, but good for them in Boston where they need heat. So he put some of these rooms that faced west, and that gave him the 360 rooms. So he got the design pretty much set. And I want us to look for a few minutes here about the incredible social consciousness that Alto had in designing this dorm. He's thinking of the lives of these students and how this dorm is going to impact their life. So, for example, there are some rooms that are triples, three people to one room. It's quite a big room, but three people to one room. And the idea was that those were for freshmen, and that your freshman year you would come and you would have two roommates. Now also, this wasn't, it isn't like your spoiled generation. This was like when it was, nobody had suites, nobody had, you know, private baths, anything like that. This was, but three was not unusual. There were some dorms at some universities that had quads. But so they had three to a room here. And there was a bathroom right there that all of these shared. And then there was a big living room here that kind of spilled out into the corridor. So all of the freshmen would live there, have a dining room, have anybody coming and going. You saw everybody's door. You were tempted to sort of sit. If somebody was in the living room playing ping pong or something, you might stop and chit-chat with them before you went into your room. And then there were a series of double rooms across the hall. And those were primarily sophomores. In this In the living situation at MIT, people live in the dorm 4 years. So they pretty much spend their whole 4 years there. So your freshman year, you might live in one of the triples. Your sophomore year, you might graduate to one of the doubles. And those doubles, these guys would be taking that calculus class. They took it last year that these guys are taking right now. So if you got a question, you could always go across the hall, and there's somebody there who took that class last year. And they know from the same freaking professor, probably. And so there's the ability to kind of get help and have interaction there. And then there are a few little, those are more like senior rooms. They're individual, private singles. But a few of them are down here because there's some seniors that still like to, they never grew up. They still want to, you know, party like the freshmen. They still want to be kind of crazy and like the freshmen. And they maybe like mentoring the freshmen and being the big dog and telling them how, yeah, back in my day, blah, 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 whatever. So there's a place for a few upperclassmen. But there, that end of the hall, which is about 30 people, is clustered around that living space and that bathroom, and that's a kind of social unit. And then as you get a little older, you go maybe to be a junior, then you'd begin to get more in the singles here, and they have their own living room and their own bathroom, and that's maybe about 20 people there. And then around here, there's really even, you know, more privacy, but still a little bathroom and living room, and about 15 people here. So it's about 60, 75 people on the whole floor. And the idea is that you got freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, so that there's vertically integrated. All the freshmen aren't made into a ghetto. All the seniors aren't made into a ghetto. They're all living on the same floor. They see each other when they wait for the elevator. They see each other when they go up and down the stairs. They see each other passing in the hall. But there also are a kind of freshman lifestyle, a little more gregarious, getting to know people, more like a senior lifestyle. I'm doing my thesis, just stay out of my hair. I got my five friends. We're good. And you know, that's happening over here. So there's different lifestyles, but that nice sinuous corridor, by its bends, it identifies some subgroups, but it still has a continuity that brings all 60 to 75 people together. Very carefully designed. Linking all those floors together is this big cascading stair. And now it's not like a fire stair that you wrap around, because when you have those wraparound stairs, if somebody's on that stair two floors below you, you don't have a clue they're there. It's not a friendly thing. It doesn't put you in contact. It doesn't give you eye contact with other people coming and going. It's just that the moment you turn a corner and then, jam, there's somebody there. But you can't see them above or below. But this cascading stair, you walk out into it, and you see the whole flight of stairs. And it also has nice natural light, big windows. It's a place where, and it's a little wider than usual and has areas at each floor that bulge out and make a little niche there. So that it's a stair that's friendly. And you see somebody down the stair, you know, pop out on the third floor while you're on the fifth floor and say, yo, Joe. Hold up, I'll walk to campus with you. Or you're walking up the stair, they're walking down the stair, you stop and chat in one of these little niches that's off to the side there. It's a place that it's easy and natural to have interaction. Not consciously, but unconsciously. It just gives you all the cues that I can have social interaction here. Those two cascading stairs converge at the front door. The front door then takes you to the rest of the campus in that direction. And of course, right at that front door, that's where the mailbox is and the front desk and a little living room with a big fireplace and the bigger living room and dining room. They're all at that hub where the stairs come down and converge. Again, thinking of nested communities, my little freshman community of 20 people, my larger freshman-sophomore community of 40 people, my larger floor of 70 people, my larger whole dormitory of 360 people, all of those working together into various social units that you can be a part of. And then at the heart of all of it is this big interactive social area, which is the dining room and the living room. The dining room is on the lower floor, has a beautiful view out these windows to the Charles River. Then the whole ritual there was you would have dinner on the lower floor, you'd come up this big stair, and you'd have coffee on this balcony around. And they would invite faculty members to come and have coffee and have dinner. And it was kind of a, it was socially polite kind of in this place. And this big grand stair that invites you to come up, beautiful views when you get up there. And, on a nice afternoon, people are spilling out on the terrace and they're looking at the view and they're having their coffee. It encourages you to hang around after dinner and socialize and get to know your classmates, but also faculty members if they're visiting there as well. So a whole dorm really, really thought through in terms of architectural determinism. How do we give these people the best chance at making friends, feeling settled in, having a community, having social interaction, being able to get help when they need it on their academics or on their dating life or whatever. You get fix up, some junior knows a girl at Wellesley he's dating and she knows a freshman, and so pretty soon you got a hookup. And it's just good social planning. Now, there was a guy here at UT, so I knew this dorm super well. So one day in Gregory Gym, I see this guy with a Baker House t-shirt. And they had a very distinctive t-shirt because the Baker House was spelled out in letters in the shape of the building. So it's Baker House spelled out with that wavy curve. So super distinctive t-shirt. And you don't see many Baker House t-shirts in Gregory Gym. So I walked up to the guy and introduced myself. And so, did you like to live in Baker House? Or did you get that at a secondhand store or what? And he said, yeah, I lived in Baker House all 4 years when I was at MIT. I then graduated, did my PhD in chemistry at MIT. Now I'm a postdoc here at UT. And so I just, started chit-chatting with him about Baker House, about what his experience had been there. And I got the best freaking testimonial you can imagine. This guy said, I was like from the Midwest, and I was a classic nerd. I was completely socially inept. I did not know how to make friends. I did not know how to meet girls. I was scared to death going away to MIT because I knew no one there, no one from my high school. I didn't know anyone. And I had just resigned myself to the fact that I was going to lead a solitary life. I did not know how to make friends. I was smart. I could do really well in my classes. And that's what my college was going to be about. But I resigned myself to that because I knew I could not make friends. So he then got assigned to Baker House and immediately got thrown into one of those triples with two other guys. And it was actually very uncomfortable. He was uncomfortable undressing, changing his clothes. I mean, he had his own bedroom at home. He was embarrassed. He was, it was uncomfortable. But what he found out really quickly was these other two guys, they feel just like me. They're nerds too. And they don't know how to make friends either. And we're all in the same boat here. And they're embarrassed as hell when they get down to their skivvies too. And we can kind of all get over it together. And so they immediately, he said, within the first week, we were like, okay, we're going to be friends with each other. And that took a huge burden off. Okay, I'm going to have some friends here after all. So the three of them bonded. And then, of course, they got to know their other freshman cohort on the hall here. And then they got to know the sophomores across the hall. And he said, by the end of the first semester, I had a lot of friends. I had a lot of people who could help me with my studies. I had a lot of people who could even fix me up with a girl. And something he never had done. But he said, so I lived there 4 years. And I loved Baker House. And he totally understood that it was the design of that building that helped him make friends. And it was a huge thing for him. And he just gave this wonderful testimonial. So I said, dude, would you come to my class and tell exactly that same story? And so he was like, oh, yeah, cool, that'd be great. And so I said, now, wait a minute. There are 340 people in this class. And he just went pale, like, oh, shit. No, I don't think I can do that. I'm not good in crowds. I'm not good in front of a lot of people. And I said, dude, you can do it. I know you can. So I can still picture him standing at the back of the room back there, sweating bullets, Oh, my God, he looked like Richard Nixon on TV, just sweating bullets. Oh, 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 panicked. And, you know, and he comes down here and he stands up on the stage and he tells that story. And everyone in the entire room is just rooting for him because it's so clear he's so uncomfortable. But also how incredibly endearing it was to hear him tell this story about how he overcame his fear of making friends. And it was the freaking building that did that. He came to my class for 2 years until he finished his postdoc. And he came every semester. And it was fantastic. I'm sorry I can't bring him back again for you, but I can tell you, it changed his life. And that's the kind of impact a well-designed building like Baker House can have. Everything in the building is about the people. Each student has a window. Their desk is below the window. And there are 360 windows in the building, one for each student in there. When you get a collective group, like a living room, they have bigger windows. When you get the bathrooms, they have smaller windows. You can just read in the building what the function, what the life, what the activity of it is. Now, if you remember in Rasmussen's book, he talked a good bit about Baker House, and he talked about it as a great anthill of activity. He had the same observations. It's just an amazing place to accommodate this notion of architectural determinism. Okay, short story about just down the street from Baker House. In the 1970s, MIT was about to build a new dormitory. Now, Baker House was sitting down there being extremely successful down the street. But they were smart enough in 1975 to realize, well, that works for a certain kind of student, but there are other kinds of students that maybe would like a different kind of environment. And especially in the 1970s, when there was a lot of kind of rebelliousness, and so they wanted to offer an alternative. And they built what they called New House. This is Baker House, the end of it right there, just down the river, the same south orientation. And there are six smaller houses. So the idea here is that some people get a little intimidated by 360 people in my living group. So let's break it down to six smaller houses with 60 people in each house. And the other thing they wanted to accommodate was maybe special interest houses, like there was a French house where everybody spoke French all the time. There was a German house where everybody spoke German. So they instead made these smaller group houses, and three of them on one side, three on the other side. On the ground floor, and here they did not have a centralized dining hall. Here everybody has a little kitchen, small kitchen, assigned to a group of 10 people. And so there's 60 people in there. There's six kitchens with 10 people in each kitchen. But instead of putting them distributed up on the floors, they put all six little kitchens together on the lower floor. And then they're next to a common dining area. So yeah, you can cook for yourself and you can manage your refrigerator with your other cohorts. But then when you go to sit down and eat it, you're not eating by yourself maybe because nobody of the other 10 is eating at the same time. But you're in an area where you're likely to run into someone else. And then the ping pong and TV rooms and things like that are down there as well. So you kind of have a social center on the lower floor. And then on the upper floors, two suites of six on either side with common rooms and bathrooms and so on for that. And then a connecting corridor so people can go back and forth to each other's houses without going out in the bitter cold of the Boston winter. Shared courtyards in between these where they can, you know, have outdoor activities, grill, do other kinds of things. Again, a different way of living, but it's not one way. There are many possibilities, all of which could be sensitively designed to student lifestyles. Now, this last example, I want to emphasize, yes, it's the arrangement of rooms, but it also is other factors, other architectural factors that are deterministic as well. This is a monastery for a group of Dominican monks designed by Le Corbusier in the 1950s. It's called La Tourette. And this was an unusual thing. Dominican monks are usually urban monks. But this was an experiment to see what it would be like to be cloistered. That is, totally taken away from society. And these monks would live here all their life and have no interaction with people from outside. So they're monks that had not been trained in that way, but how do I change myself into the kind of person that only has a relationship with God? I have no sense of community. I have a sense of relationship only between myself and God. And that's kind of the goal of a cloistered monk. So it's very isolated out in the countryside. The building is, in fact, lifted off the ground, so there's really no connection to the outdoors. As originally conceived, no one would go in the building except the cloistered monks. If you visited, and that would only be very rarely, they might have a visitor. There were three little visitor rooms where an outsider could come and visit with a monk. But by and large, no one from the outside came in, and the monks never left. This is what the plan of the building looked like, all of these little monk cells around a corridor. And then there's a big chapel here where they have their services. On the lower floors, below the two floors of monks' rooms, there are things like the refectory, the dining hall, the library, some study rooms, things like that. But it's really meant not for social interaction. So I visited there one time, and it was when there was still a place for cloistered monks. But they'd relaxed the rules a little bit at that point. We got there late at night. We just were kind of trying to locate it. And then the monk that met us at the door said, well, you can come back tomorrow, and I'll let you come in, but you can't come in now. And he said, so where are you going to stay tonight? And we said, well, we don't have any plans. And he said, you'll never find anywhere to stay around here. That was a stupid, stupid thing to do. How could you possibly come out here at night and you don't even have a place to stay? Okay, come inside and you can stay here. So we stayed at La Tourette that night. And it was really amazing to witness this lifestyle. So we went to dinner, and at dinner, no one said a word. All you heard was the cutlery and the plates, but no one said one word. The idea was there was no interaction. Late in the evening, they had vespers in the chapel, and that was just an amazingly moving, emotional experience. But the idea of the monastery is to encourage you to be alone with God, to reject all material things. Anything that smacks of comfort is to be rejected. So the whole thing is made of this very tough, very kind of craggy concrete. You know, monks used to wear hair shirts, extremely scratchy, uncomfortable clothes, because they were not to succumb to material pleasure. The idea was to keep yourself austere and isolated from any comfort of the world. So all of the building on the inside is concrete, very, very harsh. There is this big chapel at the end. There is one thing you do as a monk is you circumambulate, you say your prayers, and you walk when you say your prayers. And in traditional monasteries, often that was in the courtyard. But here it's on the roof. And there's a wall all the way around there where you walk around and you say your prayers. But the wall is higher than your head so that you see nothing. You just, it's the most beautiful countryside around there, but you see nothing. You just walk in this tunnel and say your prayers, because the landscape would be a comfort, and you're not meant to have that kind of pleasure or comfort. Even at the end of the hall, there's a window down there. There's a concrete baffle in front of the window, so you can't see the landscape out. You get reflected light in, but you don't get any of the landscape. This little sliver of a window there is just not at your eye height, so that you can't see out. And even that is a courtyard out there anyway. You just see into the other part of the building. The floors are unbelievable here. It's very, very thick padded linoleum, so that when you walk, it makes no sound whatsoever. The idea is that you are not present here. You don't make a sound. And the people in their cells over here don't hear you as you walk by. The cell itself is, I could touch either wall stretching out my hands. It's just this long, skinny, very small thing with just a hook for your garment, a sink for brushing your teeth, a bed that goes along one side, and a desk. And that's where you live and you spend your time communing with God. But then in contrast to that, there is the chapel. And the chapel is full of dramatic light, beautiful color. And as I said, you know, when the monks are chanting their vespers, oh my God, just incredibly beautiful sound and music. And that's where there is pleasure. There's pleasure when you're connected to God, but the physical world is not a place of pleasure, not a place of comfort, not somewhere you even want to live. So there's a spot, many little spots in the chapel for each monk to say the Mass and to say them concurrently. But again, it's all in isolation by themselves. Now, I would say that if I took any of you and put you in La Tourette Monastery for 5 years, you would become a radically different person, an amazingly different person, because the building would tell you ways of living so foreign to what we think, it would be a dramatic change. Okay, Twitter card question today. I want you to tell me some building that you think has had an influence on your behavior. Some place, some building, some city, some neighborhood, something that you can identify as, this had an influence on my behavior.